At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
It is all over but the signing on that big relief bill. So now, how fast do you suppose they can shovel $1.9 trillion out the door? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, today the 10th day of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. And here we are, a year less one day of the unofficial but widely recognized beginning of the pandemic affecting our daily lives. And in that relatively short, but it felt much longer period, we have gotten three authorized vaccines in this country and trillions of dollars in relief that has worked its way through this economy. And as soon as President Biden signs his relief plan on Friday, there's going to be another $1.9 trillion on the way. And yes, we can talk about inflation and the output gap and whether the economy actually needs that much money. And we have talked about it. Thank you very much. But right now, short term, it's kind of a logistics problem. And it ain't going to be fixed right quick. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams gets us going.
One of the first effects of the plan that we'll feel will be another round of relief payments, $1,400 for most people. And the IRS now has quite a bit of experience getting those out the door.
They've done this twice before. In each case, they did this at record speed.
Janet Holtzblatt is a senior fellow at the Tax Policy Center.
So I'm feeling confident that most people could receive that third round of payments sometime in the next couple weeks.
The plan also sets up new programs to help entertainment venues and restaurants, and that money may take a bit longer to work its way through the systems.
I would assume that it's going to be over the course of the next, what I would say, 3 to 9 months.
Everett Sands runs Lendistry, a fintech lender that helps process small business loans.
I think they will launch these programs, they will get the capital out. But when you're talking billions of dollars and hundreds of billions of dollars, it just takes time to deploy capital.
The hundreds of billions for state and local governments may take even longer to make it into community coffers, but
the good news is they know it's coming and they can budget and plan accordingly.
Aaron Klein is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He gives the example of the more than $30 billion allocated for public transit.
If I'm running a subway system, I don't necessarily need the check to have cleared by Uncle Sam. I need to know that he wrote it.
Which, says Klein, is also the case for individuals and businesses. Sometimes just knowing money is coming lets you breathe a bit easier. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Lest you think I mentioned inflation out of nowhere as I was setting up Kimberly's story, I did not. We got the latest read on inflation at the consumer level this morning. It is still mostly dead. The headline consumer price index was up 1.7% in February from a year ago. For some context here, the Federal Reserve has been killing itself for years now to get that number up to 2%. So what does this morning's reading tell us?
This number tells me that inflation is still fairly well contained in the U.S. economy.
Julie Smith is a professor of economics at Lafayette.
I think that inflation is very likely to continue to be volatile over the rest of 2021.
Some ups and some downs, maybe some spikes, but
I think that most of those increases are likely to be temporary.
Because
even though lots of people are sitting on lots of savings, they will eventually finish spending those dollars. Then those prices will go back to the longer term trend where they've been before the pandemic began.
Which is, regular listeners to this program will know, what Fed Chair Jay Powell and Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen have been banking on. One quick weedy inflation thing here. That 1.7% number, that's not actually the key measurement. The one you want to look at is what's called core inflation. Last month, it rose just 1.3%, so not even as close to 2% as the Fed wants, because it strips out food and energy prices.
I have noticed that the price of gas has gone up.
Exactly, because food and energy prices are volatile.
I'm also lucky that, you know, my husband does a lot of the grocery shopping, so I don't have to go to the store and see the prices there.
Exactly. Food prices have been going up, too, as we have been telling you. Economist Julie Smith there for us at Lafayette. Wall Street on this Wednesday. Can you say Dow 32,000? Sure. I knew you could. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There was news out of the second biggest school district in the country last night. Los Angeles schools have come to an agreement with the teachers union that some in-person classes are going to start again within the next 6 weeks, that is, as teachers are able to get vaccinated. The longer this pandemic has dragged on, the more contentious the school issue has become. Heated, sometimes acrimonious. But as Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reminds us, it is complicated, too.
Slightly more than half of Americans think schools should not reopen until teachers are vaccinated, according to a recent poll from the Pew Research Center. But views about reopening have shifted since last summer, says Pew researcher Juliana Horowitz.
Fewer now say the health concerns, you know, the risk to teachers and students should be a major factor. Concerns about students falling behind academically are now more common.
But those attitudes vary widely between groups. People of color, especially Black respondents, were most likely to be concerned about health risks and to support vaccinating teachers before opening schools.
I think that's a logical step, yes.
Taj Sutton is an education advocate in Brooklyn who's kept her two kids home in remote classes.
Not because we don't value academics, but because our children cannot learn if they are scared. They cannot learn if their teachers are sick.
She says the same historic inequities that have left the Black community vulnerable to COVID have also left local schools without resources to ensure safety. And yet,
families of color and women of color are experiencing the disproportionate harms associated with school closures, right?
Caitlin Collins is a sociologist at Washington University. She says frontline workers are disproportionately people of color earning low wages, and school is often a critical caretaking resource for them. But she says we shouldn't be pitting the needs of children and parents against the safety of teachers.
Prioritizing teachers and conceptualizing them as essential workers who should be at the front of the line for vaccines, in my mind, is a very logical way to think about school reopenings.
At least 14 states have not prioritized teachers for vaccination as the CDC recommended. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
You get up tomorrow morning, early maybe. You want to know what's going on in business and the economy. Fire up the stream, turn on the actual radio. Whatever you do, David Brancaccio and the Marketplace Morning Report. Check it out. A lot happens in an economy in a plague year. Happenings that are arguably more pronounced, definitely more noticeable in the centers of that economy. According to the Real Estate Board of New York, commercial vacancy rates in Manhattan are up nearly 70% over last year. And in that funny way that capitalism works, rents on retail spaces are down. Same thing is true in what are sometimes called the outer boroughs. That includes Brooklyn. But there are some signs that commercial real estate there is starting to come back. Marketplace's Samantha Fields went to have a look.
When Pooja Bavishi wanted to open her specialty ice cream store a couple years ago, she looked at probably 50 or 60 spaces. Eventually, she found a cute storefront in Brooklyn on a street with lots of little upscale boutiques and restaurants. In 2019, she opened her shop called Malai.
We do a lot of Indian-inspired ice cream flavors, just flavors of my childhood, flavor memories that I have.
There's masala chai, red chili chocolate, rose with cinnamon roasted almonds, and one Bavishi came up with for the Hindu festival, Holi.
Fennel seeds and cardamom and saffron and black pepper, and mixed with almonds.
Malai had only been open for a year when the pandemic hit, and it closed for almost 4 months. But Bavishi says people started ordering her ice cream online. A lot of ice cream.
Our shipments went up by 1,200%.
1,200%. That's why on a sunny, freezing morning, Bavishi is driving around Brooklyn with her real estate brokers, Peter Schubert and Abby Chang.
So Carroll Gardens, about 10 blocks down.
She's looking for a second, very different kind of space where she and her staff can store, pack, and ship pints and pints of ice cream.
That's fine, quarantine.
Here?
About 10 blocks away is a much more industrial area with warehouse-type spaces Bavishi wants to see.
There's a little tiny, like, office here.
This is nothing like the little boutique ice cream parlor feel of her store. This metal garage door opens into 2,000 square feet of empty space.
This is great because the UPS truck could just, like, come up here.
The pandemic has completely upended Bavishi's business model. She's gone from mostly retail to mostly e-commerce. And to keep growing that part of the business, she needs this second location. There are a lot of potential options. Her broker, Peter Schubert, at Terra CRG, estimates that between 10 and 20% of commercial real estate in Brooklyn is vacant right now, at least officially.
On top of that 10 or 20%, we know that there's kind of the shadow inventory of these other spaces, which haven't quite hit the market yet. You know, I think we're at some kind of a record number, probably historic number, that in some cases are in the 20 to 30% range.
But Schubert says the market is starting to turn around.
I feel we hit some inflection point sometime in the last 6 or 8 weeks.
He's getting a lot more calls from prospective tenants after months of almost none.
It's been a terrible year.
Michael Pinchik owns dozens of buildings with retail space in Brooklyn. He is also starting to get calls from prospective tenants.
A lot of new entrepreneurs are going to have an opportunity to open shop when that wouldn't have been possible because the rents have been affected and they are down somewhat.
Not nearly as much as some tenants expect, though. Maybe 5, 10, 15%, he says, depending on location. Even so, it is a tenant's market, and Pooja Bavishi is looking to take advantage.
To think that just a year ago I was looking up bankruptcy laws, and a year later I'm looking for a second space. Like, it's exciting, and I'm really proud. Like, I'm really proud of the company, I'm really proud of my team.
And she's ready to sign another lease to see how much more her business can grow. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Just celebrated my 51st birthday.
Hope you saved me a piece of cake. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 464 points on this Wednesday, just shy of 1.5%, closed at 32,297. NASDAQ down 4 points, basically flat, 13,068. S&P 500 up 23.6%. Ended at 3,898. A concise lesson today in how seriously Wall Street takes those estimates of a company's profits. Falls short of analysts' estimates, guesses, I don't know, take your pick. Like Tupperware Brands did today, your shares could fall by almost 20% like Tupperware Brands did today. But beat those estimates like Build-A-Bear Workshop, and shares could climb 22.5% like BBW did today. Remind me to tell you sometime the story of when I met the person who runs Build-A-Bear. Anyway, bonds rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.52%. You're listening to Marketplace.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look, payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. President Biden has promised to be, and these are his words, the most pro-union president you have ever seen. As yet unknown how well he's going to be able to deliver on that promise. Democrats in Congress, though, are trying to help. The House passed the PRO Act this week. That's P-R-O, Protecting for the Right to Organize, some of the strongest protections for unionizing since the 1930s. The bill's fate in the Senate is, well, it's unclear, but as Marketplace's Jasmine Garst reports, not everything has to become law to have an impact.
Among other things, the bill would forbid employers from retaliating against workers who organize. And it would weaken so-called right-to-work laws, which allow people to work in unionized jobs without actually joining a union. Todd Vachon with Rutgers University says the bill is coming at a crisis point.
We've seen jobs reclassified as gig work, and people are working more and more hours and unable to pay their bills and make ends meet. So I just think workers are really fed up.
Meanwhile, the National Retail Federation called the PRO Act the worst bill in Congress, saying it will interfere with workers' independence. The PRO Act doesn't have enough bipartisan support, but Joseph McCartin at Georgetown University says it's a fight worth waging in public.
Because by waging that fight, you help educate people to the issue and to the need for change.
A Gallup poll last year found that 65% of Americans support labor unions. That's the highest percentage since 2003. Alex Colvin at Cornell University says some Republicans are taking note.
Should they try to be more of a workers' party? Well, this is kind of where the rubber hits the road. Are they actually willing to support some additional worker rights?
In other words, for labor, even if the PRO Act doesn't pass, having this conversation is a big win. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
There's a movie that's getting buzzier and buzzier as award season grinds on. It's already got a Golden Globe under its belt. Minari, written and directed by Lee Isaac Chung, is semi-autobiographical. It's about a Korean-American family and, more broadly, immigrants and what they go through to get a chance in this economy. I talked to Lee Isaac Chung the other day.
This was a film that I wanted to make to capture a feeling I have about my family, about my history, and also what I was going through in my present day as a husband and a father.
It's a little bit, too, about, and you've said this in some other interviews, it's about looking for the American dream in a way, right?
I guess so. A lot of the plot revolves around the father figure really pursuing this dream of farming, which I felt that me as a 40-year-old, I was kind of pursuing my own dreams as a filmmaker and seeing myself in his work. So, yeah, there is that driving the plot in many ways.
You were, I want to make sure I get this right. You were about to not leave filmmaking entirely, but step away as this film got big, right?
I thought about quitting filmmaking just because it was becoming so difficult for me. So I didn't know if the script would ever get made. I just thought, I'm going to have this script, and if my daughter can see it one day, that'd be great. So this is all quite a surprise that life has changed so much in these past couple of years for me.
So are you stuck now as a filmmaker since this one's getting big?
I'm stuck in a way, but I kind of reframed my thinking where I don't feel like filmmaking is what defines me anymore. Like, I feel like I'm much more defined by my family and other things in life that I feel are much deeper to me.
One of those things clearly is your heritage, your family, what they went through to come here. And you looking at that in the process of making this film, I think, and saying, these are interesting decisions my parents made. And that plays out in the script as the mother and father in that script kind of, you know, pursue that hopeful future.
Yeah, that's right. I really wanted the story to be more about the way that this family finds each other through the process of seeking out success and seeking out a dream, and not so much about whether or not they'll succeed at that dream. And I think that's what I was kind of going through in my own life and something that I wanted to process myself.
When you made your Golden Globes acceptance speech, that was your daughter on your lap, right?
That was. She was sitting next to me.
Next
and then
to you, yeah.
As soon as the announcement came up, she just jumped right into my lap, and you see the laptop screen start to shake because she kicked it in the process.
Why did you want her to be in this moment with you?
So 2 hours before we were going on, my daughter said, "Can I sit here next to you?" And I just listened to her. And I thought if this were happening in other times, I would not be able to bring her with me. You know, I got to take advantage of this. And she got so excited. She went and picked out her clothes, and my wife helped her get dressed. And it was so special being able to share that with her.
We were talking very briefly, you and I, before we turned on the microphones, and I suggested you're probably really busy now, and that's probably not a bad thing. I wonder though if the pressure that comes with this attention is worrying you as you think about the next project.
To be honest, I try not to worry so much about the work anymore. And part of the process of making this film was letting that sort of anxiety go, to let myself be anchored more in my family. The pressure in some ways I feel it, but it's been great to have these opportunities. I am very grateful for them.
Yeah. You know, it's so interesting that bit about not worrying about the work and being anchored in the family, because this is a film you have made about an immigrant family, and you're a guy who comes from an immigrant family, and the stereotypical American attitude toward work is got to work all the time, and family damage sort of, you know, that's kind of the side effect. And that's an interesting thing to hear you say.
Yeah, I think it is something that I've wrestled with all my life. I'm sure a lot of your listeners have also struggled with this. Yeah. It's just part of what it means to live here. And I feel it with this pandemic even more. You know, we're really trying to balance home life and work life, and it's kind of bleeding all together at the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Every day, every single day. Lee Isaac Chung, he's the director and the writer of the new film, which is kind of amazing. It's called Minari. Isaac, thanks a lot for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Kai. This is great.
Up at the top of the program, we talked about what this morning's report on inflation means big picture. But as Professor Julie Smith reminded us with the gas and the food examples, where prices actually are might not match where statistics and reports say they are. So as we do from time to time, back we go to our price-checking panel of regulars.
This is David Romer in Denver. As usual, meat seems to be getting more and more expensive every month, and I wonder if that has something to do with the fact that I'm seeing that pet food seems to be more expensive than it used to be. Of course, we now have a third dog, so that's probably part of it. And another thing we've noticed, we have friends and family that are looking to buy houses. I don't know about anywhere else, but in Denver, the cost of a house has skyrocketed. It's 10 to 15, sometimes 20% more than it was a year or two ago. I can't imagine having to look for a place right now and seeing those prices.
Hi, this is Sudipto Chatterjee from the San Francisco Bay Area. I was at my local neighborhood grocery store recently and learned that the price of goat meat had gone up by about $2 per pound. So I asked the store owner why that is the case. Apparently, most of his goat supply comes from the ranches in Texas, and because of the storms, the supply was down, so the prices were up. I've also been keeping an eye on work-from-home office furniture, and there are no more sweetheart 30-40% off deals that were here just about a year ago.
Hi, my name is Kaya Price Dennis. I'm calling from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The only thing I've noticed is, besides gas prices going up, they're going up everywhere, is food prices are actually coming down considerably in Pittsburgh. Just celebrated my 51st birthday, and my 50th birthday last year was the last time that I went out to eat in a restaurant. Pretty amazing that this has been a year. But prices from where I'm sitting here in Pittsburgh are pretty decent.
Thanks to David Romer in Denver, Sudipta Chatterjee up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and Kaya Price Dennis, 51 years young, in Pittsburgh, PA. Final note on the way out today, two stock market items of note. First of all, GameStop. Shares back up to $265 at the close, hit $350 at one point today. I'm going to just leave that there. Also, though, a company called Roblox started trading this morning. It's a gaming app for kids which has gotten super popular during the pandemic and lockdowns. It is now worth, as of the close today, something like $38 billion. You do got to wonder how they're going to do once everybody's back in school, though, right? All right, we got to go, but here is your moment of economic context. It's more of a recommendation today, actually. Neil Irwin of the New York Times, also a semi-regular guest on this program, I guess you could say, had a column this week that I thought I might bring to your attention. Move over, nerds. It's the politician's economy now is the headline. Neil's through line in this piece is that now, and really for the past year, with all the fiscal relief that Congress has passed, the balance of power in running this economy has changed, as it should, Neil says, from the Federal Reserve, Chair Powell and the gang, to Congress, lawmakers, accountable to the people. It's a good piece. Check it out. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Robin Edgar, Drew Jostat, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Jay Siebold, Liana Squilacci, Charlton Thorpe, Ben Tolliday, and Becca Weinman. They are, of course, the ones coming into the studio, so the rest of us don't have to, unless your home internet is terrible. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.